party or more who's self-represented. And in family law, it's something in the order of 40 to 50%. And some estimates have it as high as 60%. There's an obvious impact on the ability of the court to help them sort out the issues that they bring before it. The survey of the judges that was done by one of our justices recently established that for chambers hearings, there's an increased reading time before and after chambers. The decision maker needs more time to sort out the issues and get to the bottom of it, and the opposing litigant needs more time to review and respond. Often the main issues in a case involving a self-represented litigant are obscured. They're more difficult to get to, understand, and resolve. And often, because of lack of preparation or lack of adequate notice, the matters are required to be adjourned. That's true of not just chambers matters, but trials as well. There are difficulties with people who come to court with the best of intentions to present their case, but simply don't have the knowledge base or the organizational skills to do it without assistance. And we do notice that on a fairly regular basis. It is regarded, I think, as the lack of counsel is regarded as a hindrance to the proper administration of justice and to effective decision making. The second thing I thought I would do after just touching on that is just to talk a little bit about the evolution of the law that has arisen domestically with respect to the right to legal representation in court. The problem of a justice system that favors those who can afford it over those who cannot has been around for a long time. But we're living in a more complicated and a very expectation-rich world right now, and that changes the perspective on it. It alters, I think, the mindset towards what is required to furnish a proper justice system. In her foreword to the report on access to civil and family justice titled A Roadmap to Change, Chief Justice McLaughlin wrote, "Let me start by saying that the problem of access to justice is not a new one. As long as justice has existed, there have been those who struggled to access it. But as Canadians celebrated the new millennium, it became clear that we were increasingly failing in our responsibility to provide a justice system that was accessible, responsive, and citizen-focused. Reports told us that the cost, delays, long trials, complex procedures, and other barriers were making it impossible for more and more Canadians to exercise their legal rights." What the Chief Justice was referring to was a concept of access to justice that's broader than simply the provision of legal aid, but it certainly includes it. In the 33rd Viscount Bennett Memorial Lecture delivered by Justice Cromwell of the Supreme Court on October 2nd, 2011, and you'll probably be aware he chaired the group that created the report on access to civil and family justice. He said this, "Recent reports in Canada have concluded that many legal needs of people in lower and middle income groups are not being met. I refer to the reviews of legal aid by the Canadian Bar Association and by the Dowse Commission in British Columbia, as well as reviews of legal needs in Ontario. The Ontario Civil Needs Project found that 1 in 7 low and middle income Ontarians with a civil legal problem in the past 3 years did not follow through because of cost." And Justice Cromwell emphasized that his view of access to justice was not court-centric, and it was not confined to access to lawyers, judges, and court, but it certainly included it. So I think it's important to recognize that the problem that we're dealing with, the issue, conceptually at least, is when we're talking about the broad issue or the issue of a broad legal representation, is really an access to justice issue. And the most recent case to deal with that subject matter, that is the nature and the limits of the responsibility of government to deal with questions of access to justice, is a case called Villardell versus Dunham. It's a court of appeal case at this point, but it has been argued before the Supreme Court of Canada. It was reserved in April of 2014, and I understand that the decision will be issued tomorrow. So it perhaps is timely to speak about it very briefly. That's a case that deals with the constitutionality of hearing fees charged by the Crown in the Supreme Court. The trial judge ruled that the fees, which under the Supreme Court rules could be waived by the court for the impoverished, were nevertheless unconstitutional because they materially hindered access to the court for the struggling middle class who could not afford them. The Court of Appeal overturned the trial judge's ruling on the basis that people in need could be read into the relevant rule to broaden its compass and to remedy the deficiency which had been identified by the trial judge. And in reaching its decision, the Court of Appeal relied quite heavily on the Christie case, which Lois mentioned in her presentation. And it talked about the focus on the history of hearing fees, which have been a feature of the English legal system going back to the statute of Henry VII in 1494. So history plays a good part in determining the constitutionality of an enactment. The court noted the importance of history in determining the nature and the extent of an unwritten constitutional principle that prohibits government's interference with access to justice. They then went on to acknowledge that one of the interveners had relied on some international instruments, that is, some international conventional law, in opposing the constitutionality of the tax. And they ruled that that argument was based on instruments that the absence of a judicial discretion to exempt litigants from imposition of court fees and costs without regard for the implications would be problematic. And it was on that basis that they read into the rule that the broadening of the exemption. So when we look at publicly funded legal aid, it hasn't really been part of an aspect of the rule of law engaging constitutional protection because it's relatively new in our history. The mindset that has developed with respect to legal aid really began in the late 60s and came to fruition in the early 1970s. Before then, what you find in the literature, particularly the literature written by lawyers, is really a polemic against public funding of legal aid. But if I'm reading Villardell correctly, the court in that case considered the content of the international instruments as a source to measure whether the current exemption was up to the constitutional mark. And that decision, at least in concept, is therefore support for the proposition that international instruments and obligations can interact with the domestic law to help determine the constitutionality of particular government action or inaction affecting access to justice. So if the Supreme Court of Canada tomorrow takes up that line of reasoning at all or expands it, it may provide some important guidance on the nature and the scope of the government's constitutional obligation to facilitate access to justice. That in turn may condition the ongoing and very important discussion that we're having here tonight and that is being manifested in various reports, initiatives, and actions taken by the various bar committees across British Columbia on the provision of legal aid in a much broader range of cases than it currently stands. So all I